We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores, the games every day.
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, guys? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast. No Pete today. But Darius, that doesn't mean the name Jonathan Goldfarb won't show up.
It does not. It does not. It's funny because I was playing some chess earlier this morning.
Oh, there you go.
So Goldfarb was on the mind. And I appreciate our wonderful producer, Jeannie. So Jeannie's an internet sleuther, I think, because she sent this picture of that included Goldfarb winning some juniors thing, and he was with a bunch of other juniors and they all had their trophies. And so I must say, chess is hard. Anyways, so shout out to Goldfarb. Shout out to Pete.
Well, I feel like Pete is here because we've been debating Boston and Miami still on the text thread this morning. I'm like, Pete, go back and take care of the stuff you have to take care of. But he's really passionate about this Miami topic.
You know, we will see. I think we'll get to them in the second segment and previewing tonight's game and what we think is going to happen the rest of the series. But Miami's in a pickle. But again, we'll get to that soon. What we should talk about now, I think, is the Golden State Warriors, because the Western Conference has a champion. And the Golden State Warriors are returning to the finals, Mike, sixth time in the last eight seasons. They had a couple of down years after Durant left and injuries to Steph and injuries to Klay. And they've rebuilt their team and have their three main guys back, right? The old Splash Brothers, and now with Jordan Poole and Kevon Looney taking on a bigger role and some young guys getting some minutes here or there. Moody has stepped in. We got some Nemanja Bjelica last game stepping in for Otto Porter, who has missed the last couple of games. And so the Warriors, they win in five games, and now they're waiting. They're waiting to see what's going to happen. What are your takeaways, Mike, from the Warriors, or go wherever you want, from that series, what the Warriors are doing, Luka and the Mavs, any direction that you want to go here?
Yeah, I mean, the last time that you and I saw each other in person was at the Warriors regular season game against the Lakers. And at that time, it was later in the season, and it was a little bit murky what was going to happen, because they of course, had started out of the box so great. And I remember early in the season, I think our collective feeling on the pod was, if we had to pick between them and, well, I guess I should speak for myself, and you can clarify if this is how you felt, but they started out just as well as Phoenix did. And I liked their ceiling more than Phoenix's ceiling, you know, based in part just on that Steph, Chris Paul, like who in a series, who can sustain the way that they play for longer. And, you know, with Chris Paul eventually wearing down, and then also just some of the support pieces that they had, Wiggins looking like he was looking at the time, Poole starting to step up, Otto Porter, like a big athletic wing out there, Draymond looking better, Looney, who's become a bigger story in the playoffs, certainly looking better. And so then Steph gets hurt and they go through their different spell, and Klay is, you know, still kind of coming back, and it wasn't completely clear, Darius, but they really, once the playoffs started, have kicked it into another gear. And to beat Dallas the way that they did, even if Dallas had a decent shot to win game two, being up 19, you could just tell by the end of it, Dallas was kind of like, yeah, we're not ready yet. You know, we're not going to beat you guys four times. And that mentally, they just couldn't handle Golden State. And I thought that was interesting.
So I listened to you guys talk the last pod and the ups and downs of the regular season and the ebbs and flows. And I think Golden State being such a veteran team, having to reintegrate Klay and doing that at the same time that Poole has had the ascension that he's had, and at the same time that Wiggins had so clearly taken on such a bigger role and found a comfort zone in his second season with the team, I just think that we probably didn't give that enough thought around the complexities of that and how that might make them look on any given night. I think a lot of times we talked about Klay as an individual and his ups and downs as a player and his sort of want to maybe get it all back faster and wanting to play to a level by sometimes maybe hijacking possessions a little bit and playing with a bit too much verve and a bit too much force, considering the other resources that were available on the team and striking that right balance. I don't think those concerns seem gone to me, Mike. And everyone has seemingly found their right position within the context of where the team is now. Does Poole catch a little bit of side eye from Klay every now and then for like missing a read or for dribbling the air out of the ball a little bit too much? Sure. I think for the most part, there is great harmony there. And they have so many good offensive players, and the way that they leverage the shooting skill of all of those guys, it's just a problem. And the Mavs didn't really find a solution for it all series.
So the key part for me too is, and we can look back at this series, and I think there's plenty to take out of it though. You know, did Golden State at a certain point, did they not get the respect, right, that they should have had as a real title contender? Whether for everybody just talking about Phoenix or even thinking about like how well Boston's playing, and they have to finish the deal when they play Miami tonight. But there was a certain part, I think, in that Memphis series, and maybe it was getting blown out on the road, where I don't know, it doesn't seem like they've been given the benefit of the doubt that they probably feel like they need, and that has helped them. I think that's helped. There's all of a sudden this chip on the shoulder of a super talented, super deep, super expensive roster, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And they really like, and they're loaded, and they've got that beautiful part where they don't feel like it's like the Lakers in 1920, right? With loaded roster, super motivated, super talented, but maybe not thought of in that way to start.
Well, it's interesting because there was always a reason to discount them. And I don't think we looked at context enough. And I'll start with the Phoenix part. Phoenix was favored because they ended up being able to manage the regular season so much better than any other team. And when you're in the top five on both sides of the ball and you're like eight games better than everyone, you are now put in a position where you should be favored. What you do with that is a whole different thing, but you should be favored at that point. And so I don't think that part is disrespect to the Warriors to favor the Suns based off of what their profile was. And getting back to the Warriors, Denver was clearly no match for them. And I think it was easier to poke holes in what the Warriors were doing to Denver based off of what Denver had brought to the table. And then I think where things got trickier in terms of how to analyze the Warriors was during the Memphis series. Because Memphis, and you have brought this up several times on the pod, Mike, but Golden State understands the problems that Memphis specifically offers them. And I think that psychologically, they understand that the players do. Like, and I think that that impacts their ability to perform a little bit against that specific style. But Memphis is just a bad matchup for them. It's in that idea of styles make fights. Memphis is the team that through their athleticism and their size and their ability to pressure the paint in ways that really can compromise the Warriors' defense.
And it's back to your rock, paper, scissors analogy a little bit, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's what Pete says a lot, right? About how are you going to solve this specific problem? And that's just a harder equation for the Warriors to get through. And I think that we probably didn't contextualize that enough. And so the fact that the Warriors came out of that at the end, and then also with Ja being hurt too, I think that made us even think like, well, the Warriors are struggling against this Grizzlies team. Like, they don't even have Ja. I think it was much easier then at that point to sort of dismiss them in a way that I think is, if not outright fair, it's totally understandable. Now, with them beating the Mavs at the way that they did, I think we've come full circle with them back to where they were at the regular season.
All right. I got one more point, Darius, I want to throw at you about Golden State and that series. And then we'll also flip over, talk a little Celtics Heat. And then I've got an AD question for you. Trying to think about the way that AD would fit into what's become a smaller postseason. And can't wait for your take on that.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
All right, so starting with Golden State here, it was great to see Klay, and you could feel the emotion in the building. You could see it. George Sedano, the game was on TNT, but George Sedano did a great interview with him on ESPN because he was there covering it for them, and Klay was super emotional, right, about kind of feeling like Klay again. And, you know, he's been pushing so hard to feel like Klay again, sometimes to the detriment of himself and the team. But I think this is why he's been pushing so hard like that, to try to find the moment. And I still don't expect in the finals that you're going to see him be able to do that routinely like he used to. I think it's still going to be a bit more hit or miss, but the threat of him doing that is one thing. And I wonder how you juxtapose that with Steph, where he's at with his game right now. You know, 8 threes a game, shooting 42%, looking a little bit more like Steph in that series than he did against Memphis. How do you contextualize their backcourt and where they are now compared to where they needed to be when they won their titles?
I think they're almost there. And I think with Poole, they probably are there, to tell you the truth. Poole's emergence as a player supplements both Steph and Klay in ways that really just make the Warriors problematic offensively, because in theory, you can have two of those guys on the court at any given time, and the defense has to treat them a certain way. I'm glad you brought up Klay. I think we all have a soft spot for Klay. I know, too, because of your long work with Michael and him being Klay's dad, you probably even have more of an affinity for Klay just based off of family ties. But Klay is just one of those universally loved players. He's eccentric. He's got a down-to-earth style in terms of personality, and he's got like a badass sort of attitude and game, the way that he plays in terms of confidence and just that want to get after it. And he will put his foot on your neck and he will compete on both ends of the floor. There's like, he brings so many qualities to the table as both a human being and as a player. There is a reason why he's universally loved.
Yeah. And just an important part of that too, is that he cares and people respond to that. You know, you can see somebody caring about their craft and caring about what they do. It's just, it's easier to relate to that. And Ernie Johnson even brought it up, right, when he interviewed him in the postseason. He's like, he said something along the lines of, I think every NBA fan, you know, maybe outside of, in that evening, Dallas, right, could feel that for Clay. And that doesn't happen a ton.
No, it doesn't. And then when you add on sort of the redemption story and the comeback element of this and like the injuries, it's just a great story for Clay and for the Warriors. In terms of Steph may not be right at the peak of his powers, but he is like still in the 98th or 97th percentile of that. The thing that he's grown into, Mike, is he is stronger than what he was 4 years ago. And his reads in terms of pass, shot, drive, jumper, he is operating at the highest level I think he's ever been in terms of that sort of decision making. Who is defending me? What is my advantage? How are they playing me? And now, what is my response to that? And that's the part where I think that he's creating stuff for his team in ways that is just hard for opponents to match.
I want you to continue here. Just one note, one stat that I thought was interesting. So his turnovers are down this postseason compared to what they've usually been. And I wonder if that plays into what you were just talking about. But 2.6 turnovers for Steph, that's pretty low considering all of the types of defenses that he encounters. Like, I think people sometimes just talk about Steph like he's careless offensively. And he is from time to time. But he's also dealing with just ridiculously slanted defenses, you know, coming at him, doing anything they can to get the ball out of his hands and rushing at him the second that he touches the ball on the perimeter. Like, consider the difference even between him and LeBron. LeBron catches the ball at the top of the key, 3-point line. You can't just send two dudes sprinting at him, right? He'll look over the top and then he'll make the pass over the top. Whereas Steph, he's getting that blitz all the time. And I think that has to do with the turnovers, but yet they're still down. So 2.6, he's usually over 3. And even for his career in the postseason, Darius, he's at 3.4. So, you know, that's a significant difference.
Yeah, I just think that he's driving more to score now instead of driving the pass. And his finishing at the rim has always been top level. He's not often thought about in terms of his skill level around the basket as like a Kyrie, because Kyrie's finishing is so flashy and it's so amazing and left, right hand and all of that. But Steph brings a lot of that to the table too. And he's got such great touch. And so, again, I think their backcourt, to answer your question again, their backcourt's close to where it was in terms of their starters. But with Poole, I think they're right there or even at a higher level than what they were in the past just because of Poole. Unless you want to continue with the Warriors, I think this backcourt talk is a good place to pivot to the other series.
Let's get there. Let me make one tiny point. Kobe finishing at the rim, I always felt like was underrated. And
yes.
I learned that in person more, I think, than anything else when, you know, people would, coming into the Laker job, people talk, oh, Kobe takes all these contested turnaround fadeaway twos and whatever. And then I got there and I'm like, oh, wait, he can get to the bucket whenever he wants. He can finish with either hand. He can ham on you. He's got English. He's got all the stuff around the rim. So I just wanted to throw that in there real quick.
All the reverse backhanded layups, the 1-foot takeoff finish, the 2-foot takeoff finish, the double
clutch.
The short
floater, the short finger roll, the baby hook, whatever you need, baby.
Mike, you don't score 30,000 something points in the league without having like just a natural feel for putting the ball in the basket. And if you watched Kobe when he was a 17-year-old in summer league, all of those shots were sort of, you saw them. Like little deceleration, the stuff that Luka does where you're decelerating and then putting that shot over the top. Like, sorry, we're on a Kobe thing now, but
you know what? Hey, never have to apologize for a Kobe tangent. Okay.
You remember, Mike, the shot that he hit against the Suns, I think in 06, where the game winner was at the foul line, right? Like after the Luke Walton tip ball, the jump ball, right? That Luke Walton won, they tap it out. But the shot that he hit to force overtime was after the smush steal, and then he got the ball in the open court, and he looked like he was going full bore to go to the basket. But what he ended up doing was decelerating and shooting that little floater as he's going out of bounds. And that sort of touch and the ability to sort of embody control, right? Those are the things that Kobe brought to his finishing around the basket that I thought really was at an elite level that isn't often talked about in terms of what his package was as a scorer. So I'm glad you mentioned that, just because I'm always down to reminisce about our guy.
Yeah, I had an idea that you'd be okay with that quick tangent. All right, so why don't we take another break and then let's pop over to the Eastern Conference.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, game six coming up, and I'm having a hard time seeing Miami win this game. I have enough respect for that franchise and these players to think that it might be a little more competitive than Boston thinks. You know, they might make a run early, but the mix of the injuries and just how Miami's playing at the time. And I think this Boston team is so difficult to play against, with their defense, not just in the starting five, but then, you know, even adding a Grant Williams and a Derek White, two of the better defenders in the league that come off the bench, you know, for them and add to their start. I just think that's a lot to play against. And I think that's got to do some with Miami missing some shots. That's been part of the debate that Pete and I have been having. And just the general way that Miami is having to try to find ways to score, and how much they have to commit to playing a certain, you know, ridiculous style of pressure defense. I just think it's all been a lot, but we didn't get your take as Pete and I were talking Boston, Miami. And so I even mentioned you a few times. I wonder where Darius would come in here. Would he come in the middle? Like, so I've been curious for your take on the series.
It's tricky because I understand what a point that you've been making, and I think that it's a real one, is that when you ask your role players to defend at the level that the Heat are asking their role players to defend at, they're going to miss shots. And the ask is so high, and the pressure, I don't even want to say of the moment, but just these games, every shot feels more important. And then when your legs aren't all the way there, it's just difficult. I do also think, though, that the Celtics are conceding certain shots in order to keep Miami away from the basket and trying to make sure that they gum things up in a certain way. And the Heat just haven't been able to make them pay. Spoelstra has spoken a couple of times about the shot quality, and I do think that he's not wrong when pointing that out. The thing is, though, is that I come back to like the injury stuff, that the Heat are dealing with more than what Boston is. I think it's easy to highlight the injuries based off of whoever's losing, right? And so, like, when Boston didn't have Smart and Horford and then they lose, it's easy to say, oh, well, they didn't have Smart and Horford. When they won without Smart, I think that that diminishes, right? And Tatum's dealing with a shoulder, right? And there's a lot of, and no one is 100% at this point, but the Heat based off of their makeup as a team, I think they need all of their guys, and they need all of their guys to play at a certain baseline of a level. And with Hero out, that's a big blow for them. And Jimmy and Lowry have not been able to reach that baseline level that they need to play at. And that's why these games have gone the way that they have. I will say, though, Mike, that if Boston comes in thinking that they're just going to win this game because they're at home and they've got all the momentum, and they do, like, I'm not counting out Jimmy Butler. Like, one of these games, his knee may just feel better. And one of these games, Lowry just might hit some shots, right? And if that's tonight, then you go to game seven, and that's when anything can happen. So Boston needs to be on their A game this game, because if they falter and they let a team with the sort of scrappiness that the Heat have, and we know that the elimination game is the hardest game to win, right? It's hardest to close a team out. That it's tricky for Boston here, but I'm kind of in the position where Miami just doesn't have enough at this point. Not taking anything away from Boston, but I would have loved to have seen Miami more at full strength in order to, and at least have Jimmy be where he needs to be, because I think that they can then supplement in other ways. So that's kind of where I am at here.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when I'm watching a series like this, if I had to pick just in terms of a rooting interest, I would certainly be rooting for Miami, you know, to beat Boston. But since I picked Boston in six, there's part of the brain where I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to have to talk about this with Pete on the podcast, right? So you're kind of rooting for what you picked. And yes. I'm like, wait, I texted this. I'm like, damn it, Pete, you got me defending Boston. Like, you know, this sucks. And one of the guys that we've been talking about is Max Strus. So Strus in the first three games was terrific, right? He was like 9 for 22 from three. He's rebounding the basketball. You know, he's making the right plays. And his shot has just completely gone away, where he's missed 11 straight threes, 0 for 4 and then 0 for 7. And he's not hitting twos either. Like, he's – so what happened? And one of the things is, you mentioned Jimmy Butler. So Butler has been terrible because of his knee, mostly, in those last two games. And so those types of shots – and there are a couple of exceptions. In fact, one that Pete sent a screenshot of, where Strus is all along. But I think that for the most part, when the defense doesn't have to really worry about Butler in the way that it did early, then they can mentally and physically, the combination of both, Strus catching that ball, knowing that he has to hit those shots, right? Because, you know, Boston lost game four by 20. They lost game five by 13.
Miami lost.
So if Strus hits, you know, 2 out of 4 in that first game, what are they? Do they lose by, you know, 14 instead? And this is the whole make miss. But if he hits a couple more threes like as usual, does that mean that they win game five? I think it's more that the pressure on role players to have to do a certain thing when the stars aren't pulling their weight and aren't making the defense really adjust. That's just what happens. And that happens because of a talent gap overall on the team.
Well, I will say, too, that some of that is flow of the game stuff, too, Mike. And I'm a big believer in just game flow. And like, what is, I know that people can believe or not believe in momentum, but I've played sports in my life. And when you feel like things are going your way, there is a bit more verve that you have. And the other team does get on their heels a little bit. And that pressure of the moment can shift. And you do start to feel that a little bit more. And so to me, it's never as simple as, well, they lost by 20. If this guy hits two more shots, then maybe they only lose by 14. To me, it always depends on what is the moment of the game in which those shots fall. How important are they or not? We've talked a bunch about, are you a garbage time all-star? Or are you an all-star all-star? Because if you a garbage time all-star, you like there's moments where those threes don't mean anything. And then there are moments where those threes feel like they're worth 10 points based off of the tenor and tone of the moment.
Of course, you're right. And of course, this is something that, like, so Strus hit that big shot, right, to secure that road win in game three, which was giant size relative to other threes. And we do the same thing when we're looking at the schedule sometimes. And I guess I say we. I want to try to remove myself because I really try not to do this. And even though I just did as a hypocrite. So, if only this shot would have gone in, you know, then they would have won that game. But what you don't do is, well, if that shot in the previous game they won had gone out, then they would have lost that game. Right. Yeah. We only seem to look at these things in the positive perspective for whatever our rooting interest is generally as a people. I think it's a coping mechanism. it's in a sense.
I go back to game one against Portland in the playoffs of the 2020 season. And I was having conversations with some Portland fans and they're like, well, don't talk about how bad y'all shot. Right. Talking about the Lakers. Like, look at how we shot. We're not going to shoot that bad again next game. But when you dig in deeper, you understand what the factors are that cause people to miss shots and what's the shot quality and so many other factors, right? And that's why at this point, it'd be silly to pick against the Celtics at this point, because with they're surrendering the shots that they're surrendering to the people that they're surrendering them to for a reason. And until the other team proves that they're going to beat that, then that's just what it is. And so I'm not counting the Heat out, but they've got a daunting task. Maybe the Heat will find some inspiration in Draymond Green saying, I know you're asking me who we're going to play. I think he was responding to Shaq, like who we want to play. I'm not telling you who we want to play. I think we're going to play the Celtics, right? And so Draymond Green is saying he thinks the Celtics are going to win on the eve of Miami having a chance to save their season. So we'll see how that goes tonight. But Mike, let's shift to the Lakers, because I know that you wanted to talk a little bit of AD and you had an AD question for me. You have not prepped me, so I'm going in blind to this. So let's talk some Anthony Davis here.
No, I really want your thoughts on how he plays against these types of defenses that we're seeing. And I don't need to ask you so much about the defensive end for AD, because I think we all know there's not like a question. I mean, he's got, you know, although we can get to that. But so Boston, and I think we can do what Draymond Green has done. And if we end up being wrong and it's Miami, then we'll talk about AD against that Miami D. We also have already seen it 2 years ago in the finals. But this Boston defense, which is playing some all-time defense, they've really been that good. And then on the other hand, Golden State has been a suffocating defense that does not get enough credit for how they play defense. And without kind of now Robert Williams is more of a pure center in some ways, in the pure in the sense of like the Dwight Howard type, the screen roll dunk, the defense, although he gets out to the perimeter better than a lot of guys. And then, of course, they have Horford. In Golden State's case, they have Draymond Green and Kevon Looney. And I just can't help but watch and think about AD and was wondering how you thought he might fit into this whole big mix and what the qualities that he has are.
So if there is any singular defender who I think gives AD issues, it's probably Draymond. Draymond has the right mix of foot speed and length and smarts and tactics, right? And a lower center of gravity. And I think that if left to his own devices to just defend AD one-on-one, he can limit AD's efficiency in ways that can be problematic, which is why, like, one of the things I want for the Lakers in general is a more skilled guard where you have to go over the top of screens, because then that opens up AD in ways where you can then get him going downhill as a finisher, which then I think only breeds more and more confidence in his isolation game, because then the jumper starts to fall and there's all of these other things. Go ahead, jump in.
No. I want to pause you on Green because do you think that in a series, which we've never seen, AD did go against Golden State and play great in the series for the Pelicans, which I guess we actually could point back to. But if with this Laker group, like I wonder if AD could figure out essentially, right? What Draymond, how he's playing him and how can eventually sort of wear him down with his size, unlike most guys could do against Draymond.
Yeah, I do think that it would be a great matchup. And I do think that AD will win enough of those possessions to make it matter, right? And this is where the difference between having AD as your number one guy and potentially your 1A or your number two guy, that changes the calculus for the opponent so much, right? Because if AD is the only guy you have to worry about, you can sell out against him in certain ways. And then he's going to have to adjust how he plays. But left on an island one-on-one to play against any player in the entire league, I think AD is going to win plenty of those matchups against any level defender. Now, especially over the course of a series where, like you said, he can leverage his size. And remember, too, like, AD is so good at like going to the offensive glass or running in transition or all of these other ways in which suddenly he's got 25 points and you're like, well, damn, how does he have 25 already? And it's the middle of the third quarter. And it's because he got to the foul line 7 times and he got 2 putbacks and he got a dunk and a layup in transition. And oh, he hit a 3-pointer. And it's just like, well, damn. Okay, that's how he did it. And so AD's range and his ability to impact the scoreboard in so many ways, I think that's where he can live and eat even against elite individual defenders. Against Boston, it's a different thing. Boston has felt comfortable switching against AD, and they felt comfortable putting guys, whether it's Smart or Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum, they have switched against him. And they felt comfortable living with that and showing him late doubles or swarming him. And I think that's still the kryptonite for AD, is when you swarm him with multiple smaller players, is how is he making his reads? Is he making them quick enough? And what are the automatics to play out of that? Because the worst version of AD is the tentative version, the version where he's not getting up enough shot attempts. And that's typically because teams are saying, you're not going to beat us, we're going to switch and swarm. And that switch and swarm idea is one where it's harder for him to navigate that. And that's where I think he needs to show the most growth as an offensive player still.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point to think about the way that he plays against Boston and what it's just a harder thing to adjust to, I guess, when a team can play you like that and when they've got that kind of perimeter talent. I think the thing that helps then in that case, though, is having LeBron on the other side of the floor, right, where eventually you can compromise the defense a little bit. But
yeah,
I went back to that series that AD had against, and this was the Kevin Durant, you know, joining the Warriors team. And AD in that series averaged 28 points, 14.8 boards, 2 blocks, 2.2 steals on 47% from the field. He only took, let's see, he took 2.5 threes a game, got the free throw line 5.2 times. So that was eye-opening for me in that, wow, like even this Golden State defense, and at the same time, they were sort of like, they weren't really in danger of losing any of those games other than the one game 3, right? That was a 33-18 game for AD. So it wasn't like they were just letting him cook, but they were kind of content to let him cook, knowing that there wasn't going to be enough around him from Holiday or from Rondo and from the rest of those Pelicans, right? So that's where I get my curiosity, A, on what would happen against this current team and what would happen against Boston. And it's so difficult to forecast what's going to be there next year because we have no idea what this Lakers roster is really going to look like. It's just something I want to get your take on. So I appreciate hearing that.
Can I just say too that against the Celtics this year, the game that stands out to me obviously is the one that the Lakers won, where they won 117-102. And I remember in the first half of that game, we were all pretty frustrated with AD. The Lakers were playing in drop coverages a bunch, and we were going over the top of screens against Schroeder, and then they were rolling downhill with Robert Williams, and Williams got a couple of dunks with AD sort of playing in drop coverages. And then the second half, Mike, the Lakers started to change things up more, and then they ended up winning by 15 points. AD didn't have this amazing offensive game. He only had 17 points, and I think how many field goals did he take? He went 7 13. For 13.
Yeah.
Right? He had 17 points, but he was a plus 17 on the night. He had 2 blocks, 2 steals, 3 assists. He had 16 rebounds, 4 of those on the offensive end. And this is what makes Anthony Davis special, right? We can talk about his offense, and I think against most teams, he's going to be the type of focal point offensive player that at least requires a certain amount of attention, and that's going to help open things up for teammates regardless. But the way that he impacts a game is multifaceted, and that's what makes him an elite player and a first level and basically a candidate to always make first team all NBA, right? Whether he will make it or not is going to depend on health and a bunch of other factors, but he is that caliber of player. And so I'd feel very comfortable going into any series against any of these playoff teams that we saw this season with Anthony Davis standing next to LeBron James, which is what, again, is why going back to conversations that you and Pete have had this week is the import then of like what you surround those guys with and how you build out the rest of the team. So, but there will be many conversations on that end of the next month or two.
All right. Well, no doubt. It's been great catching up, Darius. I know that Pete will be back on Monday as we get through. And at that point, of course, we will know what the finals is going to be. So we will preview all of that. And, you know, we may even get a Goldfarb reference in. Enjoy your weekend, guys. Thanks for hanging with us.
James has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound to Vlade. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant. 48 points. 16 rebounds. With his 8th block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a 3-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two, one.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable. For the victory. It's over.
Shot clock now to 5. Bryant.
Yes.
And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.